Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Deanna Meyer. She's a longtime environmental activist and a member of Deep Green Resistance. She's also the founder and executive director of Prairie Protection Colorado. Meyer's work currently centers on the protection and preservation of prairie dog communities up and down Colorado's Front Range. So first, thank you for being on the program, and second, thank you for your work in the world.
Well, thank you. I'm always happy to be here and have conversations with you.
Well, this conversation developed because we both saw a news article out of Arizona saying that they were attempting to reintroduce black-footed ferrets to Arizona, and the introduction was not going very well. That they had, I don't remember the numbers, but they had introduced like 100 ferrets, and they were only able to find something like 4. They were able to find a very small number. And when you and I communicated about this article, you immediately mentioned that there were some things missing from the article that you thought should have been included in any sort of analysis of what was going on.
Yes.
So can you talk a little bit about prairie dogs, a little bit about black-footed ferrets, and a little bit about what was missing?
Sure. Well, black-footed ferrets are the most endangered mammal in North America today, so they're critically endangered. They are endangered because of the eradication programs to kill prairie dogs, and that's a direct correlation between those two. Ferrets used to live in North America all over where the black-tailed prairie dogs and gunnison and white-tailed prairie dogs lived. However, I think a lot the statistics that Fish and Wildlife use, which I'm not, you know, trying to say are accurate, but they say most of, like 85% of the black-footed ferrets would live in black-tailed prairie dogs, and then 8 would lived in gunnison, 7 in white-tailed prairie dogs. And they do say that they just estimate that because really, by the time they pretty much wiped out most of the prairie dogs, there was no science or any kind of idea of how many black-footed ferrets actually existed in these colonies. And the thing that that makes it really important and central to mention prairie dogs before you even think about talking about helping the endangered ferret is the fact that these ferrets really cannot live on prairie dog colonies that are smaller than 10,000 acres, and that would be 30 ferrets. 30 ferrets need 10,000 acres, and they kind of calculate that 30 ferrets would be able to be a functioning community of ferrets that could make it in the long run. And in addition, they showed, and they've done several studies, one I was just reading today, they showed that, you know, these colonies need to be dense, not sparse. So we have a huge issue with the way people are counting prairie dogs as well when they're determining these factors regarding ferrets. So they, like, for example, like what happens now with the United States Fish and Wildlife Service, in order to be able to be eligible to receive black-footed ferrets, which they have done in several states right now, they need to have 1,500 acres on black-tailed prairie dog colonies, and then they require 3,000 acres for white-tailed or gunnisons, which is not enough at all. And then those 1,500 acres they're counting can be so sparsely populated that there would never be enough prairie dogs to feed those ferrets. And that, like, one ferret needs between 1 and 200 prairie dogs to eat a year. So they're putting some of these, like in the Arizona case, the first questions that came up to me were, well, for one thing, Arizona, they killed all their black-tailed prairie dogs, and I think they're slowly trying to reintroduce some. And these ferrets were living, I believe it was with gunnisons. And so I thought a question there was like, well, you know, gunnisons, they didn't live, they were much more, they supposedly, according to the data that they kind of made up because they didn't have much evidence to support it, they mostly lived with the black-tailed prairie dogs. Of course, there were more black-tailed than the gunnisons in white, I believe. But, you know, so they leave that out. They don't talk about the fact that that it was gunnisons, not black-tailed. Then they never talk about how many prairie dogs exist in that area in Arizona. And the articles that I see over and over again on the ferret reintroduction program always mention prairie dogs as this, like, side dish. They always usually say something like they did in that article, which is, the reason why black-footed ferrets are close to extinct is because prairie dogs there's a poisoning campaign against prairie dogs, and that's about as far as they ever go. They'll call them, like, in one article, you can read any of them, they say prairie dogs are dirt-colored animal rodents that live on the prairies that the ferrets eat. I mean, that's everything they say is so derogatory, and they just completely miss the fact of the importance. Like one article I looked up today, the title is Arizona's Black-Footed Ferret Decline, a Mystery. And that was from 2016. So they've been trying to continually, what they do is they bring ferrets into these populations that will never sustain the ferret. And then they wait, and then they add more the next year, and they bring in more the next year, and then you'll see that sometimes they can have babies. And then they get all excited because, oh my gosh, look, they have babies. And then all of a sudden the population plummets or the plague hits it. So they've had a very unsuccessful program, and they're embarrassed about it. You can barely find any information about black-footed ferret reintroductions. And my personal take is that they're doing this to the extent they did so that they can secure that money from the ESA that's devoted to this critically endangered ferret. And they whittled down the acres now because all the science is showing you need a minimum of 10,000 and 20,000, a lot of other scientists are saying, minimum of 20 for a small number of ferrets to sustain themselves in the long run. And then the Fish and Wildlife has whittled that required acreage down to 1,500 because there's no more colonies of that size anymore. So to be able to comply and continue to get the grants to go on with this program, you know, they whittle it down as far as they can to the 1,500. Oh, it's 1,000 acres now, actually. It's been down to 1,000 now. And then those 1,000 acres can have, like, there's no numbers on those. So, like, I could have 1,000 acres in, say, Boulder, and there could be 10 prairie dogs on 50, and then, like, another 20 on another. I mean, there could be a very small number of prairie dogs on that 1,000 acres, 200 maybe, 300. And then you're going to throw ferrets out there.
I think you said this before. Can you say again? So when you would have, prior to the mass extermination of the prairie dogs, when you would have a 20,000-acre village or a 30,000-acre village or however large they would be, what would be the density of prairie dogs per acre or per square mile or for whatever unit you want to use? What would be a healthy density of prairie dogs in a community?
That is, and I thought about that today too, that is so hard to find. Okay, so when you look at those densities of what land managers would say, which I don't trust them at all. They, like in Colorado Parks and Wildlife, to do a relocation, they want 10 prairie dogs per acre. Then when I looked at what they have, like at the Kanata Basin, which had a semi-successful ferret reintroduction because there was tens of thousands of acres of prairie dogs in that area, and then the plague hit them, and they lost most all of their ferrets. But, I mean, in that condition, they were saying that they averaged that on that land where the ferrets were, that there were about 25 prairie dogs per acre. Now, Conch Lobachkov might know that a lot better, John Hoagland, a more accurate number of, like, what would be considered a healthy prairie dog colony. Land managers think it's between 10 and 20 prairie dogs per acre, and I do not think, I think it would have to be a lot more than that to sustain on my land, you see that they're at greater numbers than that. And of course, in all these acreages that where they're just smushed in, they're trying to live out. And on the Front Range, there's a lot more than that per acre, and they still survive just fine. They're not skinny or anything. And on a functioning grassland, that would be so hard to determine right now because we've destroyed all of those functioning grasslands, and the land managers are guessing. I mean, that's my opinion. I would like to understand how they come up with this idea that 25 prairie dogs per acre seems like a small amount, considering that between 10 and 15 prairie dogs can live in a little coterie system within a couple burrows. So, you know, that's a really hard question to ask and or answer in, like, a quote unquote scientific way. But there used to be, just like we talked about, that one huge colony of prairie dogs in Texas, that's the one that they knew was there. And it was 100 miles wide, 250 miles long, and it had 400 million prairie dogs in that area. So we're talking about, I'm assuming, most of the grasslands that had the occupying, that had prairie dogs, were of that type of extent before they were completely eradicated and destroyed with poisons.
So you've mentioned the plague a couple times. Can you talk about, give us a history of the plague and prairie dogs, and give us the current situation with the plague and prairie dogs?
Yeah. So the Black Plague, or the Sylvatic Plague, goes through and has come from rats that were carried over here from Europeans, from the colonists. And though they carried fleas, and the fleas came over and infected our wildlife, infected prairie dogs. Prairie dogs have no susceptibility at all to plague. So it's absolutely devastating when the fleas come in and get a colony. And that's what happened at the huge colony that was one of the only thriving prairie dog colonies that had the ferrets in South Dakota. And they came through and just pretty much wiped out most of that colony and, destroyed the ferret population as well, because the ferrets got the plague too and died. And they, 97 to 99% of all the prairie dogs in colonies that are connected will die if the flea-ridden carriers of the plague come through and bite them. And so it's very devastating, and they lose a lot. Like when you look at the ferret reintroduction programs and you look over here in Boulder and just in different places, that the plague comes through quite a bit, and it'll just knock down the numbers of prairie dogs significantly, 97 to 99% to 100%, where you have these large colonies that are just gone in 3 days and there's no more of them. So what they try to do with Fish and Wildlife and the funders of the Endangered Species Act is they created a plague vaccine, and they did this to support ferrets. Like, this is what bothers me too. It's like they never say, let's stop prairie dogs from getting killed. They say, you know what, we have to try to reestablish ferret numbers because they're on the endangered species list and they're the most critically endangered mammal in North America. So we might want to try to figure out how to come up with a plague vaccine. And then they also use this thing they call Delta Dust. So it's just a insecticide, and they dust it all over prairie dog burrows, and lots of times that will hold back. So in that area where the plague, in several areas where plague has started to hit these larger prairie dog colonies where they have black-footed ferrets, they go out there and dust them, and they'll be able to save, like, the ones that haven't been bitten yet. So at the Kanata Basin or whatever, that's how they did that. They saved, like, 42 ferrets lived through that, and a very small proportion of the prairie dogs were able to get through that because of the dusting with the Delta Dust. So they have, and now they do peanut butter pellets of a plague vaccine, and they are very stingy about letting people use it, as in they being the wildlife officials, Wildlife Services, Colorado Parks and Wildlife. It's very hard to get that, and they're using it as testing, as a test, which they've been testing for several years now, and it's quite a trick to be able to get to use that on a prairie dog colony. And I think they say it works pretty well, but it also has its issues, to where when you have babies, you'd have to redistribute it continually and all of that. And they very rarely use those tools. Unless there's the ferrets involved, and then they still only usually do a small portion of the prairie dog colony with the measures that they have to try to prevent plague.
Well, there's two directions we can go here. One of them is, are the prairie dogs showing any sign whatsoever, the survivors, of developing immunity? Well, I'll ask that first, and then we'll go the other direction.
They don't have that much information themselves on it, and it's hard for them to be able to map that. So from what I've seen and looked at, there's not much research showing whether that is or not. That is one of their goals, is to try to see if there is. And in the scientific studies that they do, they show that sometimes they think maybe certain species might, but not really. I mean, when a plague comes through, and if they are not dusted, they're not showing much success with them being able to not have it, besides being able to, like, retroactively dust as soon as they know plague's in the area. And so that has had some success there. But the immunity thing, from what I've seen in the research that I've looked at, it's not really there, and they haven't been able to secure enough funding to study that thoroughly enough, or whatever reasons that is. And there hasn't been anything that I have seen that's conclusive that is actually, that they're making progress, or that they're seeing that naturally occur in any of the colonies. Usually when it comes through, they're gone.
Well, you say there's not much funding for that, and also in much of the language that you have used so far, it's clear that, and well, actually, I want you to make it more clear that this culture, you and I have talked before about how this culture hates nature, but this culture especially hates prairie dogs, just like it also especially hates wolves, and especially hates, I guess we could probably say this about almost every creature, couldn't we? Especially hates insects. Mm-hmm. But can you talk about this culture's hatred of prairie dogs?
Yeah, that's something that I always face, is that hatred, and I don't even know if I can talk about it because it doesn't make any sense. I mean, all I know is that it is deep-seated, and that ranchers have, as they hate every other native species, are very wedded to the myth that prairie dogs are disgusting rodent pests, and the agricultural whole agricultural industry hates them. So it's codified in law. So in Colorado, they are called a destructive rodent pest and a nuisance species. So that's not very helpful when you're trying to save them. And then out of the other side of the mouth, the wildlife officials will say, well, they're also keystone species. So I'm not so sure how you can do both, but they do. They encourage.
Well, when you hate nature, you can do it, because
yes.
You don't actually care that it's a keystone species. They're a pest.
No.
And they're in the
That's
way
right.
of they're in the way of cows, they're in the way of alfalfa, they're in the way of beets, they're in the way of shopping malls, and
yes.
They got to go.
Yes. And that just happens, you know, constantly here. It's so sad. I mean, right now, everywhere you go in Colorado on the Front Range, you're going to see them being actively bulldozed, poisoned, murdered. I mean, shot at. People come from from other states that don't have the prairie dogs, just so that they can sit here and shoot them. They think it's great fun, and they even call themselves the Red Mist Society, because when they shoot them, blood explodes and it turns into a red mist. So they use high-power rifles to shoot them and think it's great. They spend tons of money to do it. Totally accepted by wildlife officials and encouraged. There's no bag limit. You know, nobody says you get in, not like there should be any. I mean, there should be no killing of prairie dogs, but that happens in all states. I don't know of any state that protects prairie dogs from being shot at by these people. They, you know, and there's some parks, I mean, like national lands, that have the black-footed ferrets on their land that will not allow shooting of prairie dogs. So when you have, so environmentalists kind of use the tool of the black-footed ferret to save the prairie dog, which is backwards. And I'll say another thing about the black-footed ferrets. They were claimed, you know, they claimed that they were extinct. They called them extinct in 1979. They couldn't find any more black-footed ferrets until a farmer from Wyoming came up. Her dog had a ferret in its mouth. And so she presented that ferret to the wildlife officials. And then they went and found 18 or 17 breeding pairs of ferrets on her land. Those 17 breeding ferrets from the same family are the ones that have produced all of the genes of all these ferrets. I mean, this whole ferret program is crazy. I mean, so they're inbreeding these same ferrets over and over and over again. And then they're trying to put, there's 300 ferrets out in the wild right now, maybe 300 to 500 depending, you know, and probably less in North America. And they continually just add more when they die, add more when they die, add more when they die. So it's a real, it's a failure. It's very hard to find documents, research on this. On the successes or fit, if, you know, how many are out there, and to find, you know, what's really going on, it's kind of hidden. It's not something that anybody's proud to boast about, because, you know, and if you just think about the genetic diversity that's necessary to have healthy, stable populations of both the prairie dogs and the ferrets, and you look at the ferrets, that's pretty bad. That's a pretty small pool that you're taking out of. You're taking from one family that just keeps being captively bred. They're put in zoos. My friend saw one of those ferrets, and it was in a cage, and they said it could never be released. And they even had a little name for it. And I wrote down what they named it. But anyway, she asked, like, what if they were going to Equinox. Equinox was the ferret's name. They called it Equinox. And the reason why it was in a cage and could never be released was because it was so genetically messed up that it would never be able to function outside. It had so many genetic impairments, and then it died shortly after. But they kept it in a cage, like as their little show ferret, black-footed ferret. But I mean, so that itself is pretty crazy to me. And the fact too that, I mean, the issue is, of course, prairie dogs, you know, and the whole thing that surrounds the ferret introduction program. I'll use it too. Like, I try to get, like in Colorado, we have one area along the Front Range, the only area of public land, and it's about 50,000 contiguous acres. And they all talk, you know, all the land managers in that area, and it's Boulder, Jeffco, Broomfield, and then Rocky Flats, which is Wildlife Refuge. That's where all these lands come together and make all that. And they always talk about how they're going to do this reintroduction of ferrets. And then we have to beg, get down on our, like last year, I worked 6 months. The land manager at Rocky Flats wants prairie dogs there. But then the Jefferson County commissioners say no, because there's a law that the commissioners have to approve relocations. So they say no, we don't want those ferrets in our county, and this is federal land in their county. So we had to work 6 months with an attorney to pretty much strong arm them into actually approving a relocation. And then now the same thing we're coming up against again. They don't want to have anything to do with saying yes, so they're trying to get all out of all these things to say yes, when all these counties should actually be working together to establish, because they all say they want black-footed ferrets reintroduced here. And meanwhile, all of the remaining prairie dogs that are coming from, that could make up a very strong genetically diverse population on that acreage right now, because they're killing them in Denver, in Douglas County, in Arapahoe County, in Boulder. Everywhere prairie dogs exist, they are being flattened by the tens of thousands every month. I mean, they're just killing them, and they're almost gone. I mean, they just keep going through them. Eventually, they're going to be gone. And then they refuse to put any of them out there so that they can reach their goal. And they make it impossible for advocates or anybody who loves prairie dogs and wants to see the black-footed ferret do well and the burrowing owl and the 180 other species that prairie dogs support have a place where they can kind of survive and get away from the insanity of industrial civilization. And then they make that impossible too. So it's all crazy. And then they have articles, every article about the black-footed ferret, it's the same one as I saw as that Arizona one, like where it's just like, oh, no, I wonder why the ferrets aren't doing well. And they know why, but they would never dare speak it. And that does have a lot to do with the politics and the hatred of the prairie dogs, because, I mean, just like I saw one of our ex, I was having a lunch with my attorney, and he was good friends with one of our ex mayors in Denver, and he introduced me, and he said, Deanna fights for prairie dogs, and this guy said, oh my God, we wouldn't touch prairie dogs with like within 100 miles in politics. That's a no-no. That's something we will never go near, so good luck to you. And I'm just going, well, that says a lot. You know, I mean, he said, it's scary. You want to stick up and try to protect prairie dogs, you essentially slit your throats in politics. You're done. So
apart from the generic nature hating, and why is that? Because I'm guessing that it would be okay in politics to stick up for white-tailed deer, wouldn't it? I mean, don't people like...
Well, yeah, you can hunt them. Mm-hmm. I mean, Go ahead. No, I mean, it's just that's like Colorado Parks and Wildlife, I call them the Colorado Hunting Club now. because that's really what they are. I mean, that what their goal is to increase hunting licenses and to be able to, you know, gain their revenue that way, because most of their revenue, like 60 to 70% of all of the funding that goes to Colorado Parks and Wildlife, is set up in a way where hunters provide that income. So, and it's that whole, like the elite are allowed to enjoy wildlife to kill, and that's what they see as enjoyment. You know, so the whole like wildlife system is geared towards that for the hunters on that level. And then the Congress, the politics behind that too, are heavily dominated from that, these special interest groups, and especially agriculture. So you have like the agricultural industries who are buddies with the oil industry, who are buddies with the corporate industries, and the developers and stuff. They all are pretty influential. Their impact is very influential on legislation and on laws. I mean, right now we have the governor Jared Polis and his husband. So we have in Colorado, that's pretty amazing. It's kind of being reflected that the population in Colorado is a lot more liberal than it ever has been in the past to be able to elect a gay governor. And his boyfriend husband is a animal rights activist. And he is actually right now helping us. Now we'll see where this goes, and it probably won't go anywhere. I mean, because he's just the first gentleman of Colorado. But he is actually coming into the ring with us now. And he's saying, you better find land for these animals on this colony I'm working on now. That's a first. But that doesn't mean that his husband would ever say that. You know, I don't think his husband would ever say that. I think that Marlin is just going out and trying and doing what he does, which is advocate for animals. And the governor probably is like, yeah, you do your own thing. I can't do that. But so we'll see kind of on that, because we have a little change, a little teeny change. But, you know, most I think that, like they say, it's like slitting your throat if you're going to, because you've got such private interests that are so supportive of destroying and find it necessary to kill wild nature. I mean, prairie dogs are an impediment to destruction if you start protecting them.
One of the things that blows me away, and I think we've talked about this in previous interviews, about the destruction of the prairie dogs, is that prairie dogs are one of the most forgiving animals I know. They're not... there are some creatures who have very, very specific habitat requirements, and if those habitat requirements, you know, if old growth forest, for example, and if that's not met, then they disappear. But you and I have both seen prairie dogs living on highway medians, and I grew up in Boulder, and there was and this is just classic for everything, in between Highway 36, Boulder-Denver Turnpike, when you get into Boulder and the University of Colorado, there was a huge prairie dog village there. This is going to mean nothing to nobody from Colorado, who's not from Colorado, but between, I think, the that strip of hotels that's on the right side, and then there's Highway 36, and then there's the University of Colorado, there was maybe I'm going to say 400-yard by 400-yard field that was just filled with prairie dogs. I used to love going there when I was a kid. And, of course, that entire area has now been turned into a parking lot.
Yeah.
And that's in many ways everything we need to know. And, again, I mean, just if prairie dogs are being extirpated, that really says something, because you have to work really hard to extirpate them because they are so very forgiving.
That is true. And, you know, I think that plays into the hatred for them, too. It's like coyotes. I mean, because the stated goal of the government back in the, you know, late 1800s, early 1900s, was to eliminate them, eliminate all prairie dogs, eliminate all coyotes.
Well, that's still the stated
goal
in many places. In Nebraska and Kansas, I believe, I know for Kansas, I think for Nebraska, if you have prairie dogs on your land, you are required by law to kill them.
Yes. Here, too, there's a law that allows that.
Like, no, in Kansas, it's required. There was a family tried to reintroduce prairie dogs on their land, and the county came out against their will and poisoned them.
Yeah, and there's a law like that here too. They don't practice it much, But there is a law, and the wording of it's disgusting. And it talks about, like, if I have prairie dogs on my land, and this is written back, and that law probably was too, and they just keep the law in the books, and my prairie dogs and my neighbors are trying to grow something, and they tried to use it. We tried to bring this in court because they weren't doing it. It does specifically say that they have to be interfering with the growing of crops on the law. But if my prairie dogs started wandering to the neighbor's crop, or if they were growing hay for horses or whatever, then the police can come into my land and exterminate all the prairie dogs on my land that I want here. So that law is still, you know, that is in place in Colorado too. You know, I guess it depends on if the states want to use it, and if the municipalities want to use that to their advantage. But if they wanted to, they could legally. So, and that's really disgusting. But yeah, starting in the late 1800s, early 90s, and before, I mean, it's been very frustrating for the killers because, you know, to them, the damn things, they call them things all the time, keep popping up. You just can't get rid of them. So I think that's one of the seats of the main hatred too. Like the resiliency of coyotes and prairie dogs and, you know,
wolves,
and indigenous people. Yeah.
And indigenous humans, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's very, it's so insane. And they, go ahead.
I was just going to say, this is, you know, one of the central parts of my analysis in general is that this culture has a death urge. And when I think about this culture's death urge, I think about, you know, there were more passenger pigeons than all other birds in North America combined, and they were able to wipe them out. And the great runs of salmon were so big that they would, an entire river would be black and roiling with fish, and they've been able to wipe them out. And there were so many whales off of New England that it looked like it was consistently foggy because of their breath. And the great banks of cod were so large that they would actually be an impediment to ships, that ships would be going along, and there'd be so many fish that the ship would have to slow down. And there were so many fish on the Hudson River that when somebody would put in a net, the fish would pull the net away from them. They would not be able to pull the fish in. And we have prairie dogs by the hundreds of millions. And I also think about the American locust, that there was a locust swarm in 1870 something, I believe, that was the largest single conglomeration of a living species by weight that anybody has ever known of. And within 20 or 30 years or 40 years, they'd driven the locust extinct. And right now, the largest migration by weight in the world of creatures is the Mekong giant catfish, and that's being wiped out. So it can take these species and these groups of species who are just in inconceivable numbers and destroy them. I mean, I don't understand how, given that, people cannot understand this culture's death urge. I don't understand how they cannot understand the end point of this culture.
No. And I think a lot of it, too, is like, yeah, I never understand that either. But, I mean, it's that whole thing of, like you talked about, with declining baselines. And, like, the kids born, people just don't even know. Like, people don't even have no idea. They think, like we've talked before, that because you see prairie dogs in the median of a road, or you see them in the only lot that's available within a couple miles, crammed in and trying to survive on a for sale signed lot, that they're everywhere. Like, and they always say, oh, prairie dogs are everywhere. We need to get rid of them. They're just a little pest, and they're plague-carrying rodents. Oh, my gosh. Which they are not. The fleas carry the plague. The prairie dogs do not. But, I mean, that's the general attitude from a lot of people in Colorado. And, like, even me, I mean, I have a hard – I could everything you just said there. I mean, how am I supposed to imagine that when I've never seen it? I always want to, and I always think about who was here and what it must have been like, and then it breaks my heart. and then it just makes me want to curl into a ball and start rocking back and forth, because what we are losing, you know, and what we're leaving for future generations of all life, not just humans, is incredibly devastating to reckon with and to think about. And, you know, and it's just like tonight I have to go to a city council meeting, and just because somebody was effective enough to get a group of about 20 people to show up there to demand that Parker, Colorado, stops destroying every little last remnant of prairie dog colonies throughout the area. And it's really bad there. You drive down a road and they're plowing. They just bulldoze them there. So you get to watch the prairie dogs scrambling to the edge of their colony in horror as they're watching bulldozers destroy their only home. And they're in fact, that's better than them poisoning them, because maybe they can run across the street and find somewhere to go. But the devastation and the sadness and the fear that you can see in those animals, when they in our kin, when they're doing that, is in. It's also another thing where you go, how can anybody, just like with any atrocity, how can people witness that and not give a shit? Like, they can drive by these colonies and see the prairie dogs horrified looking at their only home being destroyed, especially after the machines are gone. You'll see them all pop up, and they're just horrified. I mean, it's so obvious. You take 1 second to look at their body language and just say, oh, you know what, I wonder, McDonald's is over on the corner, isn't it? You know, oh, let's go to a Walmart. Oh, thank God Walmart's open. I'm glad they put the Home Depot on top of it. I mean, there's just no connect, no even acknowledgement. And everybody's so addicted, you know, and that's how civilization works. It's like, keep everybody really entertained while they're on the train towards that impenetrable, like, concrete wall going 3,000 miles per hour. I mean, just keep entertaining these guys. Don't look. Don't ever dare look around. You know, don't ever dare pay attention to what is going on and what you're doing to your descendants. So, I mean, I'm always shocked, and it infuriates me. It breaks my heart. It just, and we're right in the middle of it, and nobody's awake.
And it's, you know, people in this culture try to pretend that we are the smartest species ever to exist. And it seems pretty clear that we're not very smart. And literally, killing the planet that is your only home is literally the stupidest thing that any species could do. And I don't, you know, I've spent my entire adult life trying to articulate the madness that is this culture, and A, words fail, and B, ultimately, I think that rational articulation, reasonable articulation, can't stop madness.
No, it's the same thing that you know when you talk about rabies, it's a similar thing, and that's how I see the people who are just so hate. They just hate. They hate so much. And then it's the whole idea, I think, too, of the culture's necessity of industrial civilization's necessity to trick everybody into this idea of compartmentalization, so that we can sit there and we can say, you know, even in school, we can have disciplines, right? Science has nothing to do with reading, has nothing to do with math, has nothing to do with music, has nothing. And in the land, you know, prairie dogs have nothing to do with water, have nothing to do with species, have nothing to do with health of the land. And go on like that. And like the prairie dogs, I'm learning more about their whole regenerative water role in all burrowing animals. But, of course, prairie dogs were probably the most present in the highest numbers. But, I mean, they like in Colorado here on the Front Range, in Parker, and all these areas everywhere, and then all throughout the Midwest, prairie dogs used to be at the extent that I said, you know, 100 miles wide, 250 miles long, 400 million animals in a single, you know, colony. And they had these huge, the burrows that go 6 to 8 feet down, maybe more, and big, huge, extensive fissures everywhere. And these served a huge, not only did they create the rain, like the Navajos and the Hopis and other indigenous, probably all of them would say, like, if you kill the prairie dogs, there'll be no more rain. and creating that condensation just from the moon's tide and being able to pull that groundwater up towards the surface and let it go back down just like tide so that it would actually create condensation like the rainforest. But on top of that, every time it rains, so it rains, you know, these huge holes, it all makes sense, but nobody would listen enough to believe you that are running, sitting in the seats of power. But I mean, so like in the droughts and here in Colorado, we're totally running out of water to the extent like many other municipalities that were like Castle Rock's turning their toilet water into drinking water. And they do that several places. And then you have this extraordinary just elimination and wiping out of the few members of a functioning grassland community that are left, the prairie dogs that support everybody else. And they're not thinking about like groundwater recharge. I mean, and groundwater recharge happened in large measure in this dry area in the Midwest from all the burrowing out of the animals. All these burrowing animals with these fishers, the voles, mostly in prairie dogs, did the best job at it. You'd get rain, you'd get snow, and it would go down into the burrows and be able to recharge groundwater. And now you've got all those destroyed, plugged up. There's no more holes. There's no more aeration. And the water runs off into the creeks and gets sucked up with the straw to throw out on the golf courses and to irrigate your huge, insanely, like, destructive crops. And everybody loses in the end. And, like, in Parker, they just keep building, 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 like, every day. It's a horror show on Eastern, in Parker, Aurora, I mean, Denver, I mean, all of it's just Douglas County, the whole Douglas County, Castle Rock, you just go through there and it just kills, I mean, it's just it's ecocide, it's suicide for us, and people thinking that, you know, that I killing that colony isn't going to affect me is just as insane as thinking all that melting ice isn't going to affect me. And that's what most people think. Like, who cares if the ice is melting on the poles? Who cares if we lose all the keystone species? I still have internet, and Walmart's still open. You know, and it's this funnel vision of insanity. It's like you're going to care, you know, when that day comes. You're going to care when you don't have water.
I saw this article the other day by a transhumanist politician arguing that that nature is not sacred and that we do need to turn the entire planet into human and technological uses. And I saw a lot of people responding to it by getting all outraged at this particular person. But the thing I thought was most interesting about the article was not this particular person, but instead that even though they don't explicitly say it, this is actually the view that's held by everybody from mainstream politicians to mainstream environmentalists. The mainstream environmentalists are like, yeah, we should try to protect the prairie dogs where we can, but, you know, technology's got a technology, and this culture's got to do this culture thing, and the economy. I mean, we were fighting this. I'm not talking about grassroots environmentalists, by the way. Grassroots environmentalists, the ones I've known from the beginning, have been about trying to protect specific wild places and wild beings, but sort of mainstream environmentalists have been, yeah, you know, we need to protect the wildlife how we can, but you got to make room for wind and solar, you got to make room for more technology. And that, for me, and we only have a couple minutes left, but I think one of the things I want to end with is that one of the things that has always very much that I've always loved about you is your evident love of nature. And I think the most important thing that anybody can do is to transfer your loyalty away from the system and to the natural world and then act on that. And once you do that, I think it doesn't really matter. You know, if you love prairie dogs and you fight for prairie dogs, and if you love burrowing owls and you fight for burrowing owls, and if you love black-footed ferrets and you fight for black-footed ferrets, and in each of those three cases, of course, you'd be fighting for prairie dogs because they're the source. But in other cases, you could be fighting for the Mekong catfish, you could be fighting for cod, whoever it is you're fighting for. The first and most important thing is to make your loyalty to them absolute.
Yeah, and I totally see that more and more. And it's really hard too, because I just finished reading The End of Ice, which was really good. And you know, the he leaves, you know, with a couple quotes in terms of that too. It's like, you know, when you know what's happening and you see what's happening, you know, you've got to decide how you're going to fight for those you love. And the only way you can really do that is to find loyalty to them, you know, to connect with that, with the earth, to connect with the living beings, non-human beings that you love, with the land that you love. And to, you know, with the humans you love too, because if you love humans and you want your kids or your or anyone to live through this, then you need to do something. And like he in that book, I know, because I get so depressed, because it's like we're not doing enough. And I always come back to that thing, like, well, I've got to do what I can. And hopefully other people will start understanding the situation, because the biggest problem is that most people don't understand that this is a condition of civilization, and the industrial civilization has just sped it up so much. And a quote that Dar likes to use a lot that helps me too is that quote that by Havel, I don't know how to say his first name, Vaclav Havel. He says, "Hope is not the conviction that something will turn out well, but the certainty that something is worth doing, no matter how it turns out." And that's what I do with the prairie dogs, because it gets in with this bobcat. I'm trying to stop, help on a bobcat petition and everything. And it just, you just know you're running up against a wall of people who are not going to change their minds, not in the traditional environmentalist way. And all you can do is just keep trying and just keep doing whatever you can to try to expose what's happening and to scream off the rooftops like, we're killing the planet, dude. Does anybody want to pay attention? Can anybody stop? And then you have to use the screen and the social media to get people to do that. And then you become part of the whole machinery. And then you feel like it's just tearing you up. But there's no other way to, like, wake people up anymore, because everybody's too busy being locked into the machine. So it's a very frustrating thing.
So the last question I want to ask you for this interview is, one of the things that I love about you is that you saw a problem, you saw prairie dogs getting killed, and you worked to stop it. And how can somebody go from going, golly gee, there's a problem, to getting off their butt and actually do something? What's the transition there? How can somebody who lives in Alabama and who loves freshwater mussels but doesn't know what to do, how can they start?
And I would say, like, to connect with those freshwater mussels, you know, to quit listening to the noise of humanity, to get out there and spend time with them and see how much you love them, and then use that love and that power and those lessons that you're learning from by paying attention and listening to those non-humans about what they need. And that's what I did with the prairie dogs. That's what somebody's doing right now with this Parker meeting. I mean, the people that I work with now, which is very small and few and far between, are ones who are like, I love this colony, or I love this bobcat, or bobcats in general. I am going to do this. And can you support me in it? Oh, yeah, I'll support you. You do it. I'm not going to do it, because so many people come up and say to me, there's a prairie dog colony that's going to die, or there's this, you know, animal, somebody's doing this, somebody's hunting this. Okay, well, what are you going to do about it? And I think that that's where I found my inspiration, is by, you know, for one thing, living as closely with the land as possible and trying as hard as I can to listen to non-humans. And when I loved this colony that I have out on my land now that I saved several hundred members of, when I wanted to fight for them and I started feeling defeated and what do I do? I sat down and watched them, and I would film them, and I would get my binoculars out and stare at them. And then I would be like, well, I'm going to do this. Whatever I could do to try to get attention put on that colony, go to the city council meetings, do all the absolutely horrible things, anything you can think of to do that's inspired by love and connection to those that you love that are being murdered.
Well, thank you so much for all of that, and thank you for all of your work. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Deanna Meyer. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.